That's good too. Okay, so we I'm going to have more stuff to give you on Tuesday. No one's brought the Norton Anthology, right? You have to lug it. Oh, you did. All right. No, I don't need it right now, but that's good. Because some of the stuff that I'll give you Tuesday will also be in the Norton Anthology. Some of this is in the Norton Anthology as well, obviously. But if you bought the book, any edition really should be okay. I'll also send out handouts, but it's sometimes going to be helpful to look at other examples of things that come up in class, in the course of the class. So having it with you will be helpful, and it'll also be good for you as far as exercise goes, carrying it up the hill and so on. That'll be good. Okay, so one of the things we were looking at ballad meter, we're gonna look a little bit more at ballads today, partly because so much of the formal aspects of poetry that we've been talking about come up in ballads in fairly simple ways, but just because of their simplicity, they give you a good model for a whole lot of the way poetry works. So, but before that, there's one thing that I wanted to ask you, which is how many people know about what Homeric poetry is like? How the Iliad and the Odyssey, what their existence is. That's a kind of coy question. Okay, so what do you know, Jude?
I know it's epic.
Yeah.
It's very, very long.
Okay, it's epic and it's very, very long. Yep, those are definitely two of the things to know about the Iliad and the Odyssey. A third thing to know about them is maybe, yeah.
Honestly, they're semi-historical, as like they cover the Trojan War and they cover an ancient Greek oral tradition.
Okay, say that last part again.
It's an ancient Greek oral tradition that was put to paper by Homer, but it wasn't created by Homer.
Yeah, or it may have been put to paper after Homer. But they're oral poems. So when you say they're very long, you're talking about oral poems that are very long. So let's just go back to ballads for a minute, because ballads are oral poems also. This is something we were talking about in class on Tuesday, which is to say that lots of ballads, the reason that they're anonymous, the reason they have that quality of anonymity that we were talking about, is that people hear them and then some of what they're hearing sticks with them. The powerful moments stick with them. And the less powerful moments don't stick with them. And then they recite what they remember, but they also fill in the gaps that they don't remember. And sometimes those filled in gaps are powerful as well. And then the filled in gaps get remembered by the next generation or the next iteration of the handing down or handing across of ballads. So ballads get remembered, and they are generally recited by people who have not learned to read or write. So they go back centuries, some of them, and some of you probably know about Ring Around the Rosie, right? What's the famous thing to know about it? Say it louder.
It's about the Black Death.
Yeah, does everyone know that? That it's about the Black Death? And what makes it about the Black Death? How do we know that?
Rosie refers to people who have really high fever, and then Posy isn't it an herb that they use to try and kill people?
Yeah, it's supposed to keep it away. Yeah. And what about ashes?
They burn the dead bodies.
Actually, no.
That's just a guess.
No, it's a good guess, but it's more interesting than that. So does anyone know where ashes, ashes, we all fall down? Why that line in Ring Around the Rosie? Everyone knows the line? Can someone recite it? No, I mean just the whole thing, Ring Around the Rosie. Yeah, that's what
I'm... A pocket full of posies, ash...
What about All the Girls in London Town?
I don't know that part.
Do other people know that part? All the Girls in London Town work for Uncle Josie? You don't know that part? Maybe it's too obscene? It's about prostitutes, probably? So, okay, you got the cleaned up version, I think. All right, see? If we had the Norton Anthology, actually, I don't know if it's in the Norton Anthology, but you have it. Go look if it is.
What, Ring Around the Rosie?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, any decent anthology would have that, right? Or it's, and I don't want YouTube. Okay, Ring Around the Rosie, lyrics, oh, God. okay, is it in there?
What I see in the index?
The Ring Around the Rosie. So probably not. Okay, but it is on Wikipedia. But of course they're not going to give the... okay, yeah. So they're doing the... no, they don't have this part. There are lots of variants of it. Okay, but they don't have that part. Let me just Google that. All the Girls. That is bizarre. All right, something Google doesn't know. Anyhow, then... So, Ring Around the Rosie, Pocket Full of Posy. Skip the All the Girls in London Town. Then where do you get?
Ashes, They All Fall Down.
Yeah, or We All Fall Down. Okay, and Ashes, We All Fall Down is actually a misremembering of what the line really is, which bizarrely enough is achoo.
Oh.
Because it's sneezing. So you can imagine it almost as a COVID sort of thing, that the symptom of plague, including the Ring of Roses, but it's also sneezing. And what would happen in this plague is that the last thing people would do is sneeze. They would sneeze their last breath out. So it wasn't funny. It sounds funny now, but it wasn't funny. They would sneeze out their last breath and then die. So the parody of that is, achoo, achoo, we all fall down. But then... 20 years later, that made no sense. And so achoo got remembered as ashes. And so what happens is, as oral poetry is repeated, remembered, misremembered, corrected, made more memorable, because it's the more memorable part that will be remembered, it gets... more memorable, it gets better, it gets more powerful down the generations. But a thing to notice then is that oral poetry is something that is explicitly not written, just like Homer. So the Iliad and the Odyssey are oral poems, they're extremely long, but they are recited by people and were originally recited by people who didn't know what writing was, who couldn't write and who couldn't read. Eventually, they were taken down, but originally, they were handed down as poems that people couldn't write or couldn't read. The interesting thing about the Iliad and the Odyssey is that, like Milton's Paradise Lost, what else don't they do? Does anyone know? They don't rhyme. So they are in what do we call... unrhymed iambic pentameter, do you remember? What Shakespeare usually writes, to be or not to be, that is the question. Anyone know the next line? Do you know that line? Is this familiar to you?
Yeah
okay. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. So what you may notice is it's got an iambic rhythm to it, Or it's got it's on an iambic template, but it doesn't rhyme. So one thing you could ask yourself is when we talk about iambic pentameter. So I'm sorry, that's called blank verse. So blank verse in English is poetry with meter, but without rhyme. So hence the word blank, because what you're not getting is what John Milton, who did not like rhymed poetry, at least in epic, what he called the jangling sound of like endings. That is, he thought it was just distracting to worry about rhymes at the end of lines. And most of Shakespeare's poetry is blank verse. If you open a Shakespeare play at random, and you see a speech in poetry, which, how many people have read Shakespeare plays? Okay, so remember Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, since I know a lot of you read that in Macbeth and we already talked about it, creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Remember? Okay. Life's a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. So it doesn't rhyme. So, but what people will tell you is it's an iambic pentameter. So what is the possible nagging question that might come up if people say it doesn't rhyme, but it's an iambic pentameter? What, if you were skeptical, what would your skepticism be? This might be a hard question, or it might not. If you see it, you'll see it right away. So, someone remind us, what does iambic pentameter mean?
Five iambs in a sentence, or in a line.
Yeah, not in a sentence, in a line. Okay, so five iambs in a line. Remember one of the things we were looking at when we were looking at ballads, and we will again, is whether to see them as 8 and 6, or whether to see them as 14ers. Or whether to see them as 4, 4, and 6. So what is going to determine whether you say they're 14 syllables to a line, or 4 syllables to a line, or 8 syllables to a line, or 6 syllables to a line? What determines that in a ballad? What determines that in a limerick? So, there once was a man from Cathay who was making gunpowder one day. He dropped his cigar in the gunpowder jar. There once was a man from Cathay. It's a limerick I learned in second grade. How do you know where the line endings are? Do you have any trouble with the line endings there? Where does the first line end? There once, just tell me when to stop. There once was a man from Cathay. Okay, one person, 1.5 people knew. Okay.
It's not all rhymes.
Good, yes.
So then you're saying that if you were like orally passed down that there were no rhymes, how do they know where to stop?
Yeah, how do they know in particularly that something is iambic pentameter?
Yeah.
Iambic, sure, that's not hard. But pentameter, why are they saying they're 5 feet to a line? If there isn't a rhyme marking the end of a line, how do you know you're at the end of a line? Do you see the? Do you see the, what the question is?
Yeah, but in Shakespeare, the end of the line is right in front of your eyes.
Yeah, but Shakespeare was written. This is, he's saying this is all orally passed down.
No, do you know what it is?
No.
I didn't want to open yet another can of worms, but it's not a. It's just one worm in the can. It's called dactylic hexameter. So dactylic hexameter is standard for Greek serious poetry. It was also picked up in Latin poetry. So Virgil's Aeneid is also in dactylic hexameter. Anyone know what a dactyl is? Know what a pterodactyl is? Mm-hmm. What's a pterodactyl?
Dinosaur bird.
All right, so you know what a pterodactyl is, but you don't know what a dactyl is. A dactyl is the following stress. Ba, ba, ba. That's a dactyl. It's called a dactyl because do you know what the dactyl in pterodactyl means? It means finger. Pterodactyls are winged fingers. That's why they're called pterodactyls. So do you know the term dactylography? It's an old term for typing. So a dactyl means a finger. And it's called dactylic because it's like the segments between knuckles on your finger. There's a long one and then two short ones. So that's why it's called dactylic. It's ba, ba, ba. Long, short, short. So if you think of a limerick, let's leave out the first syllable, but just so you hear the sound. There was a young man. Yeah, that's not going to work. I'm not going to try to figure this out now. Limericks are actually anapests, which are the opposite of dactyls, but if you get the lines right, you'll do it. Let's just see. I sing the body electric, the murmuring pines, and the hemlocks. That's Longfellow, and that's a famous dactylic line. The body electric, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks. So you hear murmuring pines and the hemlock. You don't need to know, there's very little written in English in dactylic meter because it's not a natural meter for English, but you can do it, and Longfellow did. But Greek poetry, Greek epic poetry, Latin epic poetry is written in dactylic hexameter. What does hexa mean, anyone know? What's a hexagon?
Six.
Six, yeah. So six dactyls to a line. So we have, in iambic pentameter, we have about 10 syllables to a line. In dactylic hexameter, there are more or less 18 syllables to a line. Usually a little bit less because there are other rules that go to dactylic hexameter. But 18 syllables to a line. So the lines are a lot longer. Nevertheless, here's oral poetry. It doesn't rhyme, just as Shakespeare doesn't rhyme in, lots of Shakespeare doesn't rhyme in English, just as Milton's Paradise Lost doesn't rhyme in English, but is written in iambic pentameter. So the opening of Paradise Lost is, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world. And all our woe with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the top of Oreb or of Sinai didst first inspire the chosen seed, how in the beginning God created heaven and earth. So that's like the first 12 or 10 lines of Paradise Lost, something like that. Did you hear the line endings? So how about, once upon a midnight dreary, tell me where the line endings are, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, suddenly there came a rapping. Yeah, what is that?
The raven.
Right. Has it like a writing desk?
Poe
wrote on both. Yeah, worked, almost works. But Poe wrote on both. Okay, so rhymes, they tell you line endings. If you have an oral poet, so you go to a Shakespeare play and you hear an actor reciting a blank verse speech, like tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, you hear someone reciting Homer out loud. You hear someone reciting Milton out loud. Do the line endings matter? Does it make sense to call them iambic pentameter? Or wouldn't it just make sense to say they're iambic and leave it at that? So what's the answer that I'm obviously hoping you'll get wrong so that I can say, no, you're wrong?
That they are not, that it's not worth calling them iambic.
Yeah, that you can say they're iambic, that's fine, because we already know what iambic means. It means that you have an alternation of two syllable feet that are, what is the alternation? How do they work? What's an iamb?
It's a unstressed stress.
Right. It's like, I think, therefore, I am.
Descartes.
Yes, good. Do you say Descartes or Descartes?
Descartes.
In English, yeah. In English, you say it as a trochee, Descartes.
Yeah, Descartes.
But in French, you say it as Descartes, which is iambic. Okay, so I think is iambic, therefore is iambic, but therefore, not so much. I am. So, but I am is not the same as I am. Another way to remember it. Okay, so you can say, yeah, you have a bunch of I ams in a row. Fine, we accept that. But why say they're 5 feet to a line? So one way that you can say they're 5 feet to a line is if there's some other way of indicating a line ending. What's an obvious way of indicating a line ending? Rhyme, first of all, yeah. So if you have a rhymed poem, then the rhymes always indicate the line ending. What's another possible way of doing it that's more subtle than rhyme but is still clear?
Punctuation.
Punctuation, yeah. That if each line is a standalone, so that at the end of a line you get a pause, maybe you get a period, which is why you were saying sentence before, Craig, rather than line. Maybe you get a period at the end of the line, and so you then have a bunch of 10-syllable sentences, and then they're an iambic pentameter. That's fine. But what's the opposite of, we talked about this a little bit, the opposite of having a period or a pause at the end of a line? No, those are related, but enjambment. So remember enjambment?
Yeah.
So enjambment is when you don't pause at the end of a line. Here, I'm going to read you what Milton said about Paradise Lost. He thought he was wrong, but he thought that Paradise Lost was the first non-dramatic poem in English. That is not a play, not Shakespeare. The first non-dramatic poem in English that was written in blank verse. So what he said about it was, this is in his, in a preface to Paradise Lost. He says, the measure is English heroic verse without rhyme, as that of Homer in Greek and of Virgil in Latin. And then he disses rhyme. Rhyme being no necessary adjunct or true ornament of poem or good verse, in longer works especially, but the invention of a barbarous age to set off wretched matter and lame meter. And he says what poetry is. He says, this is true of our best English tragedies, that rhyme is of no true musical delight, but what true musical delight is, and this is true of our best tragedies, by whom he means Shakespeare, whose plays he saw when he was a little boy. He saw them when they were first being produced. Shakespeare's last plays were just being produced when Milton was a little boy. He was 8 when Shakespeare died. 7. He was born in November. So he says, here is what true musical delight is in poetry. It consists only in apt numbers, that is to say in meter, fit quantity of syllables, that is, the syllables should be the right length. And then he says, and the sense variously drawn out from one verse into another, not in the jingling sound of like endings. So by the sense variously drawn out from one verse into another, very famous sentence of Milton's, what he means is enjambment. That is, that the sense, the meaning of a line or of a sentence will go over the boundaries of lines. So that is what it means for the sense to be variously drawn out, he says, from one verse to another, but the word verse here means line, from one line to another. So Paradise Lost begins, "Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden." So let's just do those opening lines. See if you can figure out where the line endings are. So just tell me when you get to a line ending. "Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal..." So on what?
On tree, after tree.
Okay. So a lot of syllables before you hit the table, though. So let's try to get it. "Man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe." we're several lines in.
Yeah. Disobedience?
Okay, so now count it out. "Of man's first disobedience." No.
Man's first.
Well, it's iambic pentameter, so it's going to be, "of man's first" is way too short. So,
forbidden?
What is it?
Forbidden.
So how would you set it out? Here, let's do it.
did they take away the... Yeah, here it is.
Okay, this will be easier because you'll be able to see... when we're heading towards 10 syllables. Keep going. How many syllables are we at?
11.
Why am I asking?
Did we this?
And?
Of man's first disobedience.
Did we halfway through disobedience?
10 syllables.
Oh,
yes, iambic pentameter. So 2 syllables per foot, 10 syllables per line, more or less in iambic pentameter. You know how much I hate this fucking planet. How many syllables? 11 because it's a feminine ending, but basically 10. You know how much I hate, let's say, plant or desk. You know how much I hate this fucking desk. 10 syllables. Okay, iambic pentameter. So, "of man's first disobedience and the fruit." Do you hear it? If I do it that way, "of man's first disobedience and the fruit." You know how much I hate that gosh darn fruit. Same deal. Okay, so here's the first end of the first line. "Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste." Okay, good. "Brought death into the world." And remember, we talked about death into, not death into the world, but death into the world. "And all our woe." Okay, I'll just look at you and then you'll know.
with loss of Eden. We'll just stop there.
Okay, so are those line endings real? Obviously, they're printed as though they're real. The question is, are they real? This is all a question of how we talk about iambic pentameter. Are they real? Is it the case that it makes sense to say that every 10 or usually 10, sometimes 11, because there'll be a feminine ending or there'll be some other slight variation, but that essentially every 10 syllables you get to the end of a line? Is that something real, or is that just a way of laying out a whole bunch of iambic syllables? There's a chapter in Moby Dick which is written in iambic pentameter, but it's in prose, so maybe it's not right to say it's iambic pentameter. Maybe you should just say that it's in iambic feet. But that the line endings, those are arbitrary. So do people agree with that? The Homeric version, since you said, well, if you read Shakespeare, you can see where the line endings are. Homer was reciting the poetry. He didn't know what it looked like on the page. He didn't have the idea that you could read a poem. He didn't know what reading was or what writing was. So does it make sense to talk about line 46 of book 1 of the Odyssey? Does that even make sense? Or is it, do you know that if you talk about, what is it, John 3:16? Anyone know what John 3:16 is?
It's the book of John.
Yeah, the book of John, and what's verse 3:16? That's the one they always hold up signs for in football games. Yeah, louder.
For God so loved the world.
That he did what?
His only begotten Son.
Yeah, so that's one of the most famous verses in the Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And so if you watch football games on TV, people hold up signs saying John 3:16, hoping that people in the audience will look it up and say, oh, wow, and realize how amazing what God did or what Jesus did was. So if you talk about a biblical verse, anyone know what Micah, this is another famous one, Micah 6:8 is? So that's, he hath showed thee, old man, that's wrong. He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. So, you know, if you see people who know the Bible and say, well, Micah 6:8, that's a really good one. Yeah, but what about John 3:16? I know, right? All of those verses in the Bible got numbered in the 1500s, in the 16th century. No one would have known that it was John 3:16 until the 16th century. They wouldn't even have known it was chapter 3, because the Bible was not divided into chapter and verse until fairly recently. So there's the book of John, but, and there were these lines that people knew, but it was only in order to be able to index the Bible that people started dividing the Bible into chapter and verse fairly recently, by biblical standards, in the last 500 years. And whenever anyone talks about the Bible before that, they didn't know chapter and verse. So chapter and verse was a technological innovation that actually came with the coming of printing that made it possible to point, to index, to point to a particular moment in the Bible. So if you were saying, look, let's talk about John 3:16, it's going to be what my sermon is, then people would know what you were talking about because it's all numbered the same way. Some of you may know the Ten Commandments. There's some argument about how to number them. Do people know this?
Throughout the Bible, there are arguments about, like, Genesis chapter 2, Christians started after Adam and Eve are naked, so the serpent, and Jews started, when Adam and Eve are naked. I know there's like a huge dispute between religions of which line is correct to start it on.
Yeah, but in fact, the chapter is arbitrary. So it's interesting. It's a choice that people are making for emphasis, but it's arbitrary. So what you could say is, okay, so Homer is reciting these poems, and it's only later that people divide them into lines. And that division, they just decide, okay, every 18 syllables or every six dactyls, that's going to be the end of a line. And people are going to Shakespeare plays, and a lot, we don't know how Shakespeare actually wrote his plays because no manuscripts survive. We only know how printers later printed them. And you might say, okay, the printer said, every five iambs, I'm going to decide it's a line ending. And that's just what printers did. It wasn't what Shakespeare was doing. It's quite likely that it wasn't what he was doing because paper was really expensive and he's not going to leave a whole lot of right margins empty in the paper. So is it simply the case that in unrhymed poetry, the end of a line is something that a printer decides on, let's say? Milton was blind, so he recited his poetry. He would compose 20 or 30 lines every night. And then he pretty much stayed up all night because it didn't matter whether it was night or day to him. Then the next morning he would dictate what he had composed. And was it the case that the people who took that dictation simply decided, okay, yeah, the end of every 5 feet, that's going to be the end of a line. Except that Milton says, no, it's the sense variously drawn out from line to line, by which he means that there has to be a counterpoint between sentence length and line length. That sometimes a sentence will go to the next line and it will be, this isn't a good example, but yeah, it is. So if man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. So the first sentence hits a pause after tree. So after 15 syllables. The next grammatical unit is whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, comma, maybe. It depends on the edition you use. With loss of Eden. So you see, you have two sentences of different lengths that Milton says, nevertheless, the line endings are every 10 syllables. So what does that mean for there to be a line ending in Homer, in Milton, in Shakespeare, when nothing is indicating the line ending, punctuation isn't indicating it, rhyme isn't indicating it, the only thing that is telling you that it's a line ending is that you're imposing a rule which says every 10 syllables is a line ending. So is that all that's going on with lines? Is it wrong to talk about iambic pentameter if you're talking about unrhymed poetry? Is it wrong to talk about dactylic hexameter if you're talking about unrhymed poetry? So the obviously, what the reason I'm asking this is to say, no, it's not wrong. There's a really cool reason that we can talk about lines of Homer and lines of Milton, and we can say how many feet there are to a line. There's a really cool reason to say that lines exist. That's the important thing, is that lines exist. They most obviously exist when you talk about rhymes. So when you are talking about, be it right or wrong, these men among on women do complain, how that it is a labor spent in affirming this, how that it is a labor spent in vain for love them ne'er so well, love them e'er so well, yet ne'er a deal, they love you back again. There you can hear the line endings, that's fine. But is that only rhyme? No. is it only end-stopped lines. So what an end-stopped line means is a strong grammatical pause at the end of a line, no. So why not? Now, one thing to notice in the Milton is that by respecting the line endings, you get a kind of interesting fact. You have of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe. So you have three lines in a row that end with nouns. Remember when we talked about rhymes, we said you don't want to rhyme noun with noun and verb with verb. But here, because it's blank verse, you can have three line endings, all of which head towards a noun, fruit, taste, and woe. And that noun is just a kind of mental cognitive moment where you think, okay, here are items. Here's a list of things the poetry is about. Fruit, taste, woe. And then you might notice that it's of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste. So just to remind you, the of man's first disobedience, that's finally the of there, which seems weird if you don't spell it all out, is going to be what this poem is about. It's of man's first disobedience, sing, heavenly muse. So what should the muse sing of? Of man's first disobedience. So did you all have to read, or did any of you have to read Of Mice and Men in school? Do you remember where the line is from? Anyone know?
It's a poem
by Robert Burns, which is, the best laid plans of mice and men oft times go astray. I'm translating to English. It's actually Ganga Glay. But it's the best laid plans of mice and men oft times go astray. So it's the same of in Milton that Steinbeck is using. This is a book of mice and men. That is, what is my book about? What is the topic? The topic is that this is going to be a story of mice and men. So in the same way, Milton is saying this is a story about or of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. What's happened to the second of? Does it mean the same thing as the first one?
No,
it's just the fruit of that tree. It's a much more normal use, you could say, of. So here you get a kind of normal use of that forbidden tree, but it is framing the first line of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste, there's that noun, brought death into the world and all our woe. So those, you can see that if you lay it out this way, there are subtleties to where Milton is ending the line and how he is drawing out the meaning or the sense from line to line. So again, the famous phrase in Milton is the sense variously drawn out from verse to verse, but in modern English that would be the meaning variously drawn out from line to line. Drawn out from line to line with lots of variation. That's what that means. These are all, I didn't mean to get us this deep into the weeds here, but these weeds have a lot of forbidden fruit hanging from them, so they're worth it. But there's still the question, and this is, so I'll just tell you, this is true about Shakespeare editors, that if you get two different editions of Shakespeare's complete works, one edition will print as poetry passages that another edition will print as prose. The poet Alexander Pope, whom we talked about a bit, and who we will return to, remember he's the one who says what?
When Ajax tries some rock with vast weight to throw.
What does the line do?
It's
The line two labors and the verse moves slow. Okay, so Pope also edited Shakespeare, and he printed as poetry, as blank verse, a lot of passages in Shakespeare that in the previous editions were printed as prose. And he said, no, I can see the rhythm here. This is iambic pentameter. So again, the question is, if you don't know where the line endings are, could you figure them out? If you were given iambic, if you were given an iambic pentameter passage in prose, let's say just someone typed it up and gave it to you in prose, could you figure out where the line endings were? So obviously you could do it by counting, right? So it wouldn't be that hard if you did it by counting. I don't know, let's just say we're wondering if the Gettysburg Address, well, let's do this as an example. Does anyone know the Gettysburg Address by heart? Or the beginning of it? All right. See, I think this is actually going to make the point. Or anyone know any other great speech? Let's just do the Gettysburg Address. Okay. So, fourscore, I'll just read you the first couple of sentences. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Okay, we don't know if that's poetry or prose. It's got a kind of energetic power to it, but we don't know if it's poetry or prose. So how do we figure it out?
You should count specifically iambic pentameter. Is that a really
cool? Yeah.
So we could count just 10 syllables and see if it makes any sense. Like 10 syllables in, cut it down again, 10 syllables in, cut it down again, and if it works.
All right, so let's try it. So 47 years ago, our fathers, what are we up to?
9 or 10?
I think we're up to 11.
Yeah,
47 years ago, our fathers. But that could be a feminine ending, right? So, like planet, fathers. Unstressed syllable at the end of a line. So maybe that's where the first line ends. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. A new...
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Also with a feminine ending. Conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So conceived in liberty and dedicated. So does that work? Yeah, but dedicated, like our fathers and a new nation, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged. Wait, all right. Men are created equal. Now we are engaged. That works. In a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. It's got a rhythm to it, but it's pretty clearly not iambic pentameter. And the question is, how do we know that it isn't? And I think, Craig, you were on the right track, which is, Or let's just, you know, let's just take something boring and see if that's iambic pentameter. What's the most boring thing? Do you have books for other classes with you? No, Mrs. Dalloway's not boring, and it's close to iambic pentameter. What a guess, what a lark.
Thomas Aquinas.
What is it?
Thomas Aquinas, anything by him.
All right, good. all right, here's an online text from the Aquinas Institute. For angels are sometimes called gods when the sons of gods came to stand before the Lord, and also prophets, as it is said of Moses, "Behold, I have appointed you the God of Pharaoh." This isn't working as smoothly as it might. The more boring we get, the smoother it would work. How about the New York Times today? Okay, so railroad companies and unions reach a tentative deal to avoid a strike. You know, one of the great things that Lin-Manuel Miranda does in Hamilton is that he takes things that are originally prose and he figures out how to put them in a poetic context, which is a cool thing to do. But okay, freight rail companies and unions representing tens of thousands of workers reached a tentative agreement to avoid what would have been an economically damaging strike. So how do we know that's not iambic pentameter? So freight rail companies and unions halfway through a word, good. Zenting tens of thousands of workers reached, but listen to how I had to say tens of thousands of workers, a tentative agreement to avoid what would have been an economically damaging strike. Yeah, the basic idea is that a line ending will almost always, which is to say the exceptions to this rule, and I already showed you one in this class, are about one in a million, will almost always also be a word ending. That the way you know that Homer wrote in Dactylic Hexameter is that every sixth foot is also the end of a word. The way you know that something is iambic pentameter is that every fifth foot is the end of a word. That at the end of every line, there's a correspondence, even if there's no rhyme, even if there's no pause for a punctuation mark, there's a correspondence between a certain number of feet and the last in that number of feet, whatever language you're in English it's 5, in Greek it's 6, the last foot of that certain number of feet is going to be a word ending. So again, remember that Dickinson line, after great pain, a formal feeling comes. If she'd ended it with after, then the line might have ended with aft, or formal, it might have ended with for. But after great pain, a formal feel, or feeling, it might have ended with feel, but it's after great pain, a formal feeling comes, boom, that's the line ending. Doesn't have to rhyme. You already know that if it does rhyme, it's going to be the word that will be rhymed. You don't know the rhyme yet, but you know it's the word that's going to be rhymed. In Milton, there you have a four-syllable word right in the middle of a line. Disobedience, right in the middle of a line, that couldn't be moved more than three syllables to the right. Because if you moved it more than three syllables to the right, then the line would end in the middle of that word. So line endings are also word endings. That is the single crucial principle of metrical poetry. Obviously, it's a principle of rhymed poetry, but it's a principle of all metrical poetry, that if a poem is in meter, then the line ending will also be a word ending, invariably. And, you know, it's fine, as we saw with the Gettysburg Address, for that to happen two or three times in a row in prose. But you know, let's say the odds that it happens, because words are short and we talk trochaically anyhow, is that in most sentences, every 10th syllable will be a word ending, let's say, or there'll be an unstressed just one unstressed syllable after it. Let's say that happens 80% of the time. The odds against it happening 5 times in a row are low. Even if the odds that it happens the first time is high, 5 times in a row, it's low. 10 times in a row is vanishingly small. 100 times in a row in a 100-line poem, it cannot be an accident within this universe. It would be as accidental as putting water on a stove and sheerly by accident the water freezes, because that happens to be what the water molecules do. It's possible, it just won't happen. So line endings are regular, and they always occur after a certain number of feet in iambic pentameter. How many feet?
5.
In dactylic hexameter, 6. In Alexandrians, 6. In tetrameter, anyone know? 4. Yeah. Tetra means 4. Like in Tetris. In monometer?
1.
Yeah. There are poems written in monometer. Skelton did some. We didn't look at Skelton, but I distributed some Skelton for you. In dimeter, as it's called?
Double.
Yeah, 2. 2 feet per line. So you have a certain number of feet per line. The regularity is where the words are going to end. The crucial reason to know this is that what that shows is the single most important determinant of something's being a poem is line. The lines define poetry. What makes something a poem is that it's written in lines. This is true in free verse. In fact, it's maybe most obviously true in free verse. It's where we don't think twice about line endings matter, because if you look at a piece of free verse, you're looking at its layout on the page. And, yeah.
What's your opinion on prose?
Yeah, so prose poetry is what we call the exception that proves the rule. How much prose poetry is there?
The contemporary poetry is a lot of prose poetry.
You don't think the line endings matter? I think if you look at...
A lot of them are less intentional.
They may be... what do you mean by less intentional? Can you give an example?
Well, I know a semi-contemporary person that most people might have heard of, Charles Bukowski. Some poems he doesn't care at all about ending anything. Some he does. Like, I don't know. I know Bluebird is a great poem by his where he does care about line endings.
He doesn't really care about anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an amazing poem.
Well, look at the Fantasia on the Nut Brown Maid, because Ashbery rarely rhymes and rarely pays attention to meter. He occasionally does, but rarely. So this is a decent example. The first line is straight from the ballad, be it right or wrong, these men among. And then you get something, we talked about this on Tuesday, that simply disrupts the meter. These men among others in the park, all those years in the cold, are a plain kind of thing, bands of acanthus and fig peckers. At the afternoon closing, you walk out of the dream, crowding the walls, and out of life, or whatever filled up these days and seemed to be life. You borrowed its colors, the drab ones, that are so popular now, though only for a minute, and extracted a fashion that wasn't really there. You were going. I, from your thought, rapidly to the greenwood go alone, a banished man. So the only metrical lines in that opening stanza are the first and the last ones. Be it right or wrong, these men among, and then to the greenwood go alone, a banished man. And the rest of it, if you just heard someone reciting it, you would have no idea where the line endings were, right? You could guess that maybe they're more or less the same length, so if you were given the assignment of figuring out those line endings, you might have trouble doing it. Here, I'll give you another great Ashbery poem, and here I will give you the assignment, so let's just try doing it now. Let's see. So this is a poem called The Wrong Kind of Insurance. So I'll read you the first stanza and you tell me where you want to put the line endings. I teach in a high school and see the nurses in some of the hospitals. And if all teachers are like that, maybe I can give you a buzz someday. Maybe we can get together for lunch or coffee or something. That's the first stanza. Breathtaking, right? It takes a while to see how great Ashbery is. And this isn't the normal first stanza that a person would use to try to convince people that he's great. Okay, so I'll read it to you one more time, and then you try to tell me where the line endings are. I teach in a high school and see the nurses in some of the hospitals. Sorry?
The nurses, after nurses.
Okay, so here, take it. Someone take it down. Let's take down people's choices. So I'm going to write it out as prose, or I'm going to ask someone to write it out as prose. Volunteer? You would have gotten an A in the class if you'd volunteered. It's too bad. Okay, Craig. This is going to be the only whiteboard in the whole country that has the opening of Paradise Lost plus the opening of The Wrong Kind of Insurance next to each other. Okay, so just write it out as prose.
Okay.
Okay? And then we'll figure it out. I teach in a high school. And see the nurses. In some of the hospitals. Comma. And if all teachers are like that, maybe I could give you. I can give you.
I can give you?
Yeah. A buzz someday. People know what that means? Give someone a buzz?
Call them.
Yeah. Comma. Someday is two words, by the way. That's all right. Comma. Maybe we can get together can get together
can
for lunch or coffee or something. So does that count as a prose poem? For you?
I found one.
Oh, what'd you find?
Thank you.
By who?
Aristotle's Germain, for the Black Area. It's really just a highly common text as well.
Okay, well, let's just look at this one, because it sounds very prosaic, right? Okay, say you're trying to turn this into a poem for your new Netflix TV show, which is about a contemporary poet and the poetry that he writes. And so it's got to look like poetry when we cut to the page that he has typed this poetry on, because you have this really cool new TV show. Okay, so how are you going to make that look like poetry?
I teach in a high school, Latin one.
Okay.
And she's a nurse.
Wait, so do people want that to be the end of line one? How many people want I teach in a high school?
I'm good with that.
Yeah? How many people yes? How many people no? How many people yes? How many people no? How many people are abstaining? All right, so I teach in a high school. We'll put this as a line ending. Next one.
And see the nurses.
Yeah.
Right here?
Yeah.
Okay. Next.
In some of the hospitals.
There. Okay.
And of all the teachers. Or like that too. I don't know.
Okay, wait, so where do you want me to stop? If all teachers? Notice it's and if all teachers, not in, and if all the teachers.
Yeah.
And if all teachers, yes, no?
Yeah.
Okay, all teachers. Okay, next. Or like that, maybe.
Yeah, and after maybe.
I can give you a buzz.
Someday, maybe.
You want to hear it?
Yeah.
We can get together.
The lunch is for coffee. And then last line or something.
Or something.
That's how I would do it.
All right. Interesting. Anyone want to re-lineate it? Everyone agrees with this lineation? Would you bet that this is Ashbery's lineation?
Not a betting man.
Well, the odds would be really low that you would that we would get exactly. It exactly yeah. Right. Whereas the lineation of a limerick, you'd have no problem betting that you're getting it exactly right. So, in fact, it's, I teach in a high school, and what he does is he capitalizes the first, as you do in poetry, the first letter of every line. So it's, I teach in a high school, that's right. Then, I'm not going to take us to the next line, but this is the line ending. And, capital A, and see the nurses in some of the hospitals. So, nurses was a good idea, but wrong. But yes, in some of the hospitals, that is the line. Comma. So what do I do with this A?
Capitalize it.
And if all teachers know. So if that isn't a line ending, where do you want to put it?
At the, that. After that.
Yep, that's right. And if all teachers are like that, yes. So what do we do with this M?
Capitalize it.
Maybe. I can give you a buzz. Wasn't the line ending?
Someday.
Yes. So there it is.
That's a two capital maybe.
Yep. So here's another capital maybe. So we get this parallel. There shouldn't be this. So maybe I can give you a buzz someday. New line. Maybe. We can get together. Where do you want me to stop it? So in fact, it's maybe we can get together for lunch or coffee or something, is a single line.
I feel like if you make or something, throw a line, that would be so, I don't know, I like that.
It would be dramatic.
Yeah, I like it.
But he's being undramatic.
That's true.
But the point is, okay, this is a typical example of fairly contemporary free verse. And the only thing that at first glance makes you realize that it's poetry is capitalization at the beginning of the lines and non-right justified margins. So that you have a ragged right-hand margin, which means that it's not to fit as many words as you can on the page that you decide how long a line is. Line endings are mattering. So in poetry, opening lines are marked with a capital letter, even if you're in the middle of a sentence. Of man's, capital O, of that forbidden, capital O, brought death, capital B, with, that's a capital W. You may not see it, but it's a capital W. So lines begin with capital letters, and they end where they end, and then you go to the next line and you get a capital letter. So what you get, even in oral poetry, if it rhymes, it's obvious. But if it doesn't rhyme, it's still the case that what you get is a regular appearance of a word ending corresponding with a line ending. In free verse, like this, the regularity may not be obvious, but there's a visual aspect to it that substitutes for that. And we'll be doing free verse at the end of the course. We're not going to be doing it till the end, or not doing much of it till the end, but we will be doing it at the end of the course. But what it tells you when you look at a piece of free verse, what that tells you is that line endings matter. Does anyone know the... we have 5 minutes. Does anyone know the E. Cummings poem about a leaf falling? Famous poem, maybe, no, not his most famous poem, but I think I can write it all out. Is this it? No, this is some bizarre version of it. Maybe it is. See what Cummings is in that. Index.
Oh, I know he's in the...
Yeah, all right. This isn't the standard version, but apparently maybe this is a version he did. I'm wondering if there's time to put it on the screen, but there isn't. Okay, so it's exclamation point. Here, I'm going to... B-L-A-C. Or just look up.
No, I have.
Oh, okay.
And it's all in order.
But it's not.
I don't know if it, that poem is here, though.
Bizarre. All right. I think what I would do. No, it isn't. Yeah, they didn't have the guts to put this in. All right, you know what? I'll send this to you. But this is how it begins. Can you read it?
Black against?
Yeah. So the words aren't that hard. It's black against, I'll read you the whole poem. Black against white sky, trees which from dropped leaf ago, sorry. Leaf ago's whirling. But I'll send it to you. But there it's clear that you're not going to get the poem right if you don't put the line ending in the middle of the word at the letter C. That's what is part of the point of the poem. Okay, I will send it to you. Bring in one more time the handout that I gave you on Tuesday, and have a good weekend.
Philip Larkin.
Of who?
Philip Larkin.
Oh, yes. Very much so. Yeah. I'm going to probably bring in They Fuck You Up.
Oh, that's a great poem, man.
Yeah.
The one with the parents.
Sorry?
Is it the parents fuck you up?
Yeah, they fuck you up, your mom and dad.
Yeah.
They may not mean to, but they do.
Also, the Mower by Philip Larkin.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've been reading this guy called W.D. Snodgrass.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah, I just got introduced to him, like, a friend of mine.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
He gave me a collection of his work, but it's a little harder to understand. Like, you have to know a little bit of meter and stuff, so you understand it all.
Yeah,
I'm going to ask this class, but does your knowledge of meter ruin your understanding of poetry at times?
No. It actually makes it deeper.
Does it distract you?
No, it's one of those things where you get into it for what. There's a little while where it's.
See you next week.
Bye bye. Where it's distracting, and then when you get good enough at it, so it becomes second nature. It makes the poetry that much better.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
All yeah, right, no, that's partly what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, totally. All right, I'll see you Tuesday.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye.
Yeah.
Or just right now.
Yeah, right now it's fine.
Okay, so I was just curious what really, like, you're looking for in a paper.
Yeah.
Because, to be frank with you, I haven't really written papers in a really long time.
Uh-huh. What are you majoring in?
Bio and biochem. So I've done a ton of scientific writing.
Yeah.
I missed a lot of years in high school, and then I had a wacky English teacher, so you really didn't actually write. So I'm just wondering what you're looking for.
Okay, so we'll talk about it. But basically, for you to say something interesting, for you to notice that something interesting has happened and describe what's happening.
Okay.
So the I'll talk more about this in class, but the mistake people often make is to think that a paper is showing that they understand what they were supposed to understand, like answering an exam question. And what a good paper will do is you will think about something and then suddenly you'll see something and that'll be exciting. And then you will try to make me see it.
Okay.
Okay, make sense?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
All right, see you on Tuesday. You too.